So, do you want to retire someday or do this till you die?
I want to do it after I die.
Do you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Hugh Cornwell.
He's busting my chops because I did my New York wall thing.
Yes, yes. So it's Hugh Cornwell with an E in it.
Would you introduce yourself, sir?
Yes, hi, I'm Clem Burt.
Now, this is something that I discovered that kind of amazed me. You didn't, unlike the bands we were just talking about, you didn't go the art school route. You did biochemistry. When is the last time you've used that degree?
I used it today for lunch because we went into a salad bar and they had sliced beetroot. And sliced beetroot is a wonder thing for the health. And I'm aware of that primarily because of biochemistry, because it's a fantastic cancer beater and great for the mitochondria. Have you heard of the mitochondria?
Didn't you open for mitochondria earlier in your career?
Yes, I think I probably did.
How does a scientific mind inform rock and roll?
Well, that's a very good, interesting question, Dennis, because music is a mathematical formula, isn't it? And that's why it lends itself perfectly to the internet digital, programming and all this, because it's a mathematical system.
None of us had any idea that music was going to be heard the way we hear it today. So you turn around and you say, okay, you know what? I'm a smart man. I'm not going to charge for my new record because there's no money in selling my new record, right?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was the record company. The two crazy guys in London, Australian boys, and they wanted to record the record, pay for it, and they wanted to release it. So they took me out and got me drunk, and they said, "We want to give it away." And I said, "You must be mad." And they said, "No, we want to give it away because that way it'll spread like a virus. And if it's good, which we hope it, and I think there's some good reviews for it, people who hear it and they like it, they'll want to play it to their friends, as you always do. Like we used to have cassette tapes, and they'll pass it around. And I think that was 2008. We're now 2011, 3 years later. It's still for free on the download from this website. You don't have to put your name and address or your social security number, no personal details. It really is a free lunch. And it's still being downloaded. And I think it's worked because now I'm able to come back to America more often. People are more familiar with what I've done. And not just America, but I'm going to places I haven't been to for a long time.
The fact of the matter is that is it really any different that where the money is in this business is indeed being on the road and performing and selling merchandise, and in your case, being smart enough to, you know, sell VIP tickets and offer up, you know, that really cool EP with Bobby Darin and the Everlys and Elvis and all of that sort of thing. Isn't that where the business was a long time ago, except it took everybody forever to realize it?
Exactly. I mean, before records were invented, people, musicians and composers used to have to go around on concert tours playing their music. And that's the only, and people used to go to concerts. That was what it was all about, wasn't it? So it's a return to that, really.
It's a reverse situation. The record was... The reason for touring was to sell records. Now the reason for the record is to sell touring, if you look at it kind of that way. Right. If you look at the Grateful Dead or the Ramones, they sort of had that business plan in effect many, many years ago. Neither one of those bands ever had tremendous commercial success, but all their shows would sell out. And as we know with the merch for the Ramones, and, you know, how many Grateful Dead t-shirts do you see people wearing over the last, 40 years, or Ramones t-shirts?
So, Mr. Burke, it's kind of an interesting thing because you weren't in Blondie, you're in Blondie, but you also, you know, have embraced a bunch of different bands, including, obviously, you know, playing with Hugh. And the two of you kind of met in a precipitous way through a bass player. Is that what I heard?
Well, we have a mutual friend in Steve Fishman, who is Hugh's bass player. But... Actually, you and I met here. We're having a little bit of a trip down memory lane. We met here in San Francisco in, I think, maybe the late 70s, and went to a Captain Beefheart show along with Chris and Debbie. And
wow. We were the Blondie band, and me, we were all Captain Beefheart fans, and we were introduced to a mutual friend, and we went to the show together.
Rock and roll is all about the sensuality of it, the feel of it. You know, it's really, really about precision, you know. But the way it's progressed, it seems as though people got, it's almost a cliche, getting caught up in 48 tracks and isolation and all that. But when it comes down to it, yeah, you know, a Beatles record in mono sounds brilliant, you know.
Back in the days of the Stranglers, did the record company inform studio and producer choices, or did you actually, was it part of the punk ethic that you actually got to make choices back then?
Well, at the beginning, they foisted a producer on us, and he just said the last person he'd worked with was Shirley Bassey. So we thought that was quite an interesting choice. That
appealed Goldfinger and Gold.
Yeah, it appealed to my sense of the perverse. So I thought, that's interesting, that's surreal. And then they said, and he said, okay, guys, is there any studio you'd like to work in? And we only knew one studio, but we liked it. And Alan Winstanley was the house engineer there. And it was really dirt cheap. It was in Fulham in London, on Fulham Broadway. And we said, well, we'd like to go there, please. And he said, fine. So we went down there. He noticed how good Alan Winstanley was, nicked him immediately as his engineer. and you know, the rest is amazing careers they both had, you know.
I read that you had been doing a majority of the songs anyway, that there were a few that you obviously weren't the lead singer on originally, and you figured, why not?
Exactly, exactly. And it was just a few days rehearsal to learn up the other songs. When I do the old Strangler songs now, I actually enjoy playing them because I'm not playing them the way they were originally played, you know. And I can't imagine going on stage and even doing my songs the way they sound on, let alone Strangler songs. It's, you know, I mean, look at Hendrix. People would go along to see Hendrix play and they never expected to hear it sounding the way it did in the studio, because the studio is one animal and the live is another. And I like that danger, the fact that the unexpected, you know, it can be different. There's mistakes can happen and arrangements change, and people shouldn't expect to hear records when they go to live concerts, I don't think.
But music is being absorbed in a very different way, and one of the biggest ways that people are absorbing music, and this happened back in the day, but is through soundtracks, through things like Peaches and Sexy Beast. And I actually heard that you weren't even aware that track had been licensed to the movie. Is that true?
Because I'd already left the band and things happened to the catalogue without me being concerned.
So were you watching the movie one night and next thing you know, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get $1.50.
I was in the theatre. I was in the movie theatre in London with my girlfriend at the time, and I almost fell off my chair. She went, did you know about this? And I said, no. I mean, that's what happens. I just saw We Own the Night, a film called We Own the Night, fabulous movie. What's the first song on the soundtrack? Blondie track. It was a golden era, you know, just like the 60s was a golden era too, and unfortunately we haven't really had another one since then.
I think the main influence of that era of music is something like David Bowie, for instance, and glam rock.
The T-Rexes of the world.
Glam rock, especially if you're talking about on the East Coast, in New York, and in the States, that was a pretty relatively obscure music, whether it be T-Rex or Slade or, you know, even David Bowie. And also the chameleon aspects of someone like Bowie, you know, changing his format and his style all the time was very influential for someone like, for our band, for sure. And, I mean, we've talked about that before. It's kind of obvious, you know, the Beatles or the Stones never really... They never really had one particular style. They would keep changing and evolving, as did Bowie. And all that stuff kind of went on right before, whether you want to call it new wave punk rock or whatever, all that stuff. And it wasn't a popular form of music. You know, it was a very sort of specialized thing. There weren't that many people that were interested in it. And it did, along with the MC5 and the Stooges and all that, comes together and kind of gave you that result. But... you know, and music was, rock and roll music was still young. It's beyond middle age now. And back then it was still young. It was only about 20 years old when that whole thing started happening. So there was a direct influence from the 50s and 60s and 70s into what made that middle 70s happen. You know, now it's kind of all over the place.
When somebody mentions Blondie, or somebody mentions the Stranglers, or someone mentions the Talking Heads, or someone mentions Ramones, he goes, yuck, I don't like that band.
No one says that. Did you, is that what you said?
I don't think they do. You know, and these songs hold up.
Because they're good songs.
You could also say we're bands like the Stranglers or Blondie or Ramones or whatever responsible for the demise of rock and roll too, because of the influences that we presented to a future generation, kind of watered down what we did, and then you come out with, say, with Blondie, say you come out with Britney Spears, with the Stranglers, you come out with, I don't know, Good Charlotte.
That's like a good scotch, and you're saying, give me a scotch and water and make it 90% water, right?
When we were beginning, like I said, rock and roll was still young, so those influences, but now those influences have kind of maybe become cliched in some ways and watered down modern music.
So when you look back on this, you know, this incredible life that you've lived and all of that, you know, whether it's the drugs or whether it's the 80s and all the equipment is stolen and you have to make do and write and all of these things, do you turn around and say, well, you know what, I'm here to talk about it, and that's an accomplishment in itself?
I just feel very fortunate that I'm still able to survive as a professional musician after so long, and that there are still people prepared to come and spend their hard-earned money in these hard times to come to concerts and to play the records and get some pleasure from it all. And I just feel very fortunate. I couldn't be in a more fortunate position.
And you Clem, you're in a, to me, the amazing thing, I mean, again, if I say to somebody, oh, Clem Burke, you're kind of moving on and just saying, you know what, I just want to play, right?
Well, being a drummer, I'm not really going to go out and do a solo concert, am I, for starters? I'm a collaborator, you know, and I enjoy working with artists that I respect, whether it be you or Debbie or Cyril Jordan, whatever. Is it some music? Enables me to continue playing and enjoying it. And I think I had a big sort of gunslinger attitude when I was a kid, and I think it paid off in the end of the day, as far as making a little bit of a name for myself, whatever, for what that's worth. And it enables me to go out and work with other people, and of course I don't need the money, so I can do whatever I want. Let me just back that up by saying, you know, with Blondie, you know, that was like the home base. And it's whether it's whatever the members do, you know, we have that for the home base. So it enables, I wasn't trying to be facetious about, we've been doing this a long time. That's kind of what this interview is about. And if we didn't have a little bit of success, we wouldn't be able to continue to do it. And of course, we do enjoy being artists and we enjoy playing. And we're at a certain point in our lives and our careers where we're able to go out and do it, and we really do it. I don't want to get into the cliche of it, but yeah, to play, you know, to play music and to be able to, you know, perform and you know, do all that kind of stuff. At this point, if we didn't have a level of success, we wouldn't be able to do it this way.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two songs as the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between. And I'm under moral obligation. I don't interrupt it. I don't talk. I go in with vinyl and cassettes, and I've gone in with 8 tracks, and I just go in, and I do it live. And it's a blast. Now, considering the mix I've got here, you get to do two songs of yours. You get to do two songs of yours, and then you each get to fill in a bunch of other artists.
Wow. Remarkable. What a nice concept. I'm getting hungry.